My youngest son woke up in his normal ornery fashion and was busy leaving a trail behind him everywhere he goes, as one-year-olds normally do, and went to get the oldest one out of bed, and he had fever, so she thought it better to stay home with him, so she might be here tonight. And I want to welcome the visitors and welcome Sam and Linda back with us, too. Y'all were globetrotting for quite a while, and if y'all had trotted any longer, I think you'd have trotted out of the United States, but we're glad you're back with us. All right, for a message this morning, we are going to look at the life of Saul in the Old Testament. I titled the message, Too Big to Be Any Good. Let me ask you something. Are we any good to God if we're big in our own eyes? Do you think God has any use for anybody like that? Along with that, should we strive to do big things for God? If we're not supposed to be big in God's eyes, should we attempt to do them anyway? What if we stay small and humble, but we're proud of that? Is that any good? Is that any better? I'm discovering that when people start thinking that they are very useful to God, that's about when their usefulness to God peters out. So it seems anyway. Now, to be clear, God can use anybody, and he does use anybody. God uses evil men every day to accomplish his goals. But that's not God's perfect will. It's not the way God would like to see it. He would much rather see humble, caring people that know their strength comes from God. That's much more what God would like to see. He doesn't want people with zero self-esteem and who think of themselves as worms. That can be a toxic kind of pride. We talked about that a little bit in Sunday school class. I thought Sunday school class was pretty interesting this morning. But God is looking for humble, hungry people that love him wholeheartedly. And I've heard employers share already that when they go to make a new hire, what they want is somebody that is hungry and humble. And God's the same. He wants somebody that is hungry for his word and they're humble. He wants people in his kingdom working for him that are hungry spiritually. So let's look at the life of Saul for an example this morning. So the Israelites wanted a king. Samuel was the prophet at the time, and they wanted a king for all the wrong reasons. They had an agenda that they wanted to accomplish. 1 Samuel 8, verse 19 says, "Nay, but we will have a king over us, that we may be like all the nations." They wanted to be like their neighbors around them that had kings. And Samuel tried desperately to warn them of the error of their ways. He gave them quite a list of things that are going to happen if they let this go through. He told them, the king is going to take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and for his horsemen. He's going to appoint captains. He's going to have people reap his harvest and make his instruments of war. He's going to take your daughters and turn them into his cooks, bakers, and candle makers. He's going to take your fields, your vineyards, your olive yards, the best of them, not just any of them, but he's going to take the best of them, and he's going to give them to his servants. He's going to take the best young men and women and donkeys and put them to his work. He's going to take a tenth of your sheep, and you're going to be his servants. You will cry with regret that you decided to do this, but God's not going to hear you. You'd think after a long list of things like that, maybe they would consider their ways and say, you know what, we're fine without a king. A little bit like some signs that I've seen around over the last election. They said, what if nobody was president and we all just promised real hard to be good? And you'd think maybe they could come up with a slogan like that over this time, but they didn't. They still wanted a king. And Samuel almost sends them away home in disgust. You can kind of feel the distaste for their decision. It's like, people, you should know. He was trying to save them from themselves. Anyway, that's where Saul came along and got tapped on the shoulder. He came along and got a job he really didn't want. 1 Samuel 9, 1 through 10. I think we'll read that. You can follow along if you wish. There's a lot of reading about Saul in Samuel here. Interesting reading. I can't read it all this morning. We'd be here a while, but I would encourage y'all, if y'all want some reading this afternoon, read the story of Saul. It's interesting. 1 Samuel 9, 1 through 10. Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abel, and the son of Zor, and the son of Betroth, and the son of Aphel and Benjamite, and a man of power. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice young man and goodly. And there was not among the children of Israel a goodlier person than he. From his shoulders and upward, he was higher than any of the people. And the asses of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. And Kish said to Saul his son, "Take now one of the servants with thee, and arise and go seek the asses." And they passed through Mount Ephraim, and they passed through the land of Shalish, and they found them not. And they passed through the land of Shalem, and there they were not. And they passed through the land of the Benjamites, and there, but they found them not. And when they were come to the land of Zoph, Saul said to his servant that was with him, "Come, let us return, lest my father leave caring for the asses and take thought for us." And he said unto him, "Behold, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he saith surely cometh to pass. Now let us go thither, peradventure he can show us our way that we should go." Then Saul said to his servant, "But behold, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread is spent in our vessels, and there is not a present to bring the man of God. What have we?" And the servant answered Saul again and said, "Behold, I have here at hand the fourth part of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way." Before time in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, thus he spoke, "Come, let us go see the seer, for he that is now called a prophet was before time called a seer." Then Saul said to his servant, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went unto the city where the man of God was. That's just a small snippet out of the story of Saul. It gives a little bit of a description of Paul. He was apparently a large, tall man, and pretty much just an all-around good chap from the sound of things. He was a head taller than anybody else. And it says in verse 2 there, 9 verse 2, there was not a goodlier person found in Israel. So we have this big, tall man. I don't know if any of y'all ever met this man, but there's a man that used to drive UPS truck in Batesville, the other side of Batesville. And one time I was out at a customer's place and I met this man, and he was a huge man. He was tall. I don't know how tall he is, but in my little mind, it felt close to 7 foot tall standing by him. And he was just, he probably wasn't that tall, but he was well over 6'5". And I made the customers there kind of joking with him, and I made the comment that if I'm ever in an argument, I want to be on his side. And he just kind of laughed. He was a very gentle man. And he'd made his delivery and he left, and the customer looked at me and he said, "I've known that boy his whole life. He is the most docile," forget what word he used, but basically he's a very gentle man. He about don't swat flies, I think is what the customer said. He's just a easy to get along with chap. And that's kind of how I picture Saul. A big, tall guy with a big heart, Most everybody liked him. He was willing to do the dirty work, like chase his father's donkeys around. And it sounds like they chased him for a long way. It gives several places that they passed through. I don't know how far they actually went, but he was out chasing donkeys around. Dwayne talked about chasing sheep. I don't know, a donkey is going to be much better, but anyway, they reached the land of Zuph, it says, and Saul was tired of this chase, and he wanted to go home. But his servant talked him into going and seeing the man of God, the prophet of God. He said, let's go ask him what we should do. I don't know why the servant wanted to go see him. Maybe it was kind of the novelty of seeing a somewhat famous man. I don't know. But the servant wanted to go see him. And he even offered to pay for it himself. So Saul agreed. And away they went, and Samuel was waiting on him. God told Samuel he was going to send a young man from the tribe of Benjamin, and it was who was going to be the next king of Israel. So Samuel knew when he seen Saul what was going on. And sure enough, Samuel showed up right on time. Saul showed up right on time, and Samuel invited him in for a meal. He gave him the best place to sit at the parlor and offered him something to eat. And the next morning, Samuel quietly, with no show, just anointed Saul. Even the servant wasn't there to witness it. Samuel gave him some ideas of what's going to happen on the way home. He's going to find some people. Some people are going to offer him bread, and he's to take it. And he was going to meet a company of prophets and prophesy with them. And these things happened. If you read the story, you'll see it. And Saul was apparently fairly quiet about this because he was quizzed out about his uncle, about where he was and what he was doing. And he basically said, I was just chasing donkeys around. He never mentioned he was anointed king while he was gone. You see the humility in that? He could have came back with his shoulders squared and said, I just got anointed king. I did. And it would have been the truth. But he didn't say a word like that. He was quiet about it. He was far from arrogant, just a humble young man trying not to make a show. Going on, Samuel decided it was time to announce about this king. And you'll see that in 1 Samuel 10, 17 through 21. It seems like Samuel drew lots of some kind. I'm not sure what the whole process was, but first of all, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen, and then Saul's family chosen, and finally Saul himself. And anybody want to guess where Saul was? You know he was there when all this was going on. Does anybody know where he was? What was he doing? He was hiding. Like, he was scared of it. He was hiding, I think it says, among the stuff. And so you have this gentle giant trying to, I don't know, was he curled up in a little ball trying to hide behind a duffel bag? I don't know what he was doing, but he was hiding. And God revealed that he was hiding. And some folks ran and fetched him, and Samuel told the people they have their king. He said, here's your king. Most of the people were impressed, and you can see Saul kind of, I can kind of picture him sheepishly standing there, like all these people shouting, long live the king, and he's, I don't know. I can see him almost with his head down, kind of embarrassed to be the center of attention. And most people were happy to see it. But there was a group of people in 1 Samuel 10, 27. I'll read that verse. But the children of Belial, I'm not sure how you say that word, said, how can this, shall this man save us? And they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. He didn't have full support of everybody. He knew it, and he held his peace. That takes a humble man to have most of your country on your side like that, but there's a small segment of people that won't accept you for whatever reason, and he held his peace. That takes a humble, godly man. All right, going on in the life of Saul, chapter 11, came the first test for Saul. He went back to plowing fields. How about that? He could have sat under a shade tree with his feet up and started hollering for people to bring him sweet tea. He could have done something like that, but he didn't. He went back to work. He was plowing fields. And he came home from plowing, and he heard weeping. He asked what it was all about, and he was informed that the Ammonites had a city surrounded. And the only way they were going to let the people surrender without killing them all was by gouging out their right eyes. Talk about a brutal batch of people that the Philistines were. Saul was horrified. And I think it says he cut up his oxen and sent chunks of meat throughout the land of Israel. And he told people, if y'all don't rally around me and help me out here, y'all are going to be like this. And he raised an army of 300,000 people, much to the relief of the people that were surrounded. It was the city of Jabesh-Gilead, I think is how you pronounce it. These people were very relieved that they didn't have to choose between life and wearing eye patches for the rest of their life, because Saul came with his band of people and took care of the problem. He flat took care of it. He wiped them out. Going on in 1 Samuel 11 is where the story goes on. You see in verses 12 and 14, these people that did not want to accept Saul as king. This was right after the battle with the Ammonites. The frenzied crowd wanted these people. I think they were going to kill them, it said. Or it certainly had that they were implying that. Saul was a man of character. The people that were belittling him in front of all of Israel, Saul had their life in his hands right here. He wouldn't have even had to give the order to kill him. He could have probably just stood back and the frenzied crowd would have taken care of these people. He wouldn't have even had to give the order. But he didn't do anything like that. He refused to let the people touch them. There was a statement that he made. Oh yeah, 1 Samuel 11, 13. There shall not a man be put to death this day, for today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. He saved these batch of people that were humiliating him. For an Old Testament king, that takes a humble man. That wasn't the normal protocol. Saul was human just like me and you. He could have had his way with them. And then Saul started to go downhill, it seems like. He started out so good and so strong. He had all the makings and markings of a godly leader. He didn't even want the job that was thrust upon him. He didn't want it, but he accepted it. And when God called him to it, he squared his shoulders and he tried to do the best he could. But somewhere between chapter 11 and 13, verse 9, Saul lost his focus on God and became a power-hungry man that wanted things done on his time and on his time schedule. I don't know what happened in that time frame, but it seems like, I don't know if the power went to his head. I don't know what happened, but I know he was a human just like me, and I know if I'd have been in Saul's shoes, I could have been very tempted to behave exactly like Saul did. Too big for my own good. He got a little desperate when Samuel didn't show up like he said he would. Samuel was going to come. He ordered him to wait for 7 days. I don't know if he did that to test Saul's patience, but Samuel ordered him to wait 7 days, and he was going to come offer a sacrifice. And when Samuel didn't show up right on time, Saul got antsy and offered up the sacrifice himself. And in doing so, he broke two rules, two laws. He wasn't supposed to offer an offering like that to start with. I believe that offering was just for the priests of the Levites, if I think that's right. And second of all, it seems like he was more in trouble over this than the offering itself, but he disobeyed Samuel's explicit command from God. And it seems like that's what Samuel was more worried about than anything, that he had just blatantly disobeyed him. But either way, it was the beginning of a long downward spiral for Saul. It seems he never could get a handle on himself after that. He became a powerful but useless man to God. He was powerful in Israel, but his own arrogance kept getting in the way. 1 Samuel 15, verse 17, Samuel had some choice words for Saul. He said, "When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel, and the Lord anointed thee king over Israel." When thou wast little in thine own sight. That implies that somewhere along the line, Saul got big in his own sight. And that was when God could not use him anymore. I'm not saying you can't be big and useful in God's kingdom. I am saying when we think we're big and useful in God's kingdom, and we think we're irreplaceable in God's kingdom, and that God couldn't do without us, that's when we come too big for our own good. We have to understand all our talents, our health, our resources, anything we possess is a direct result of God blessing us. And we can't ever think we can do this stuff on our own strength. We can't. Let me tell you about an airplane. Don't groan. Y'all know I like airplanes, but have y'all ever heard of the spruce goose? I don't know if a few of you have. So it was 1942, and the U.S. was in the middle of a world war, and kind of on the losing end of it. They had lost a bunch of boats to the Germans, and they felt what they needed was an airplane, a huge airplane to transport stuff across the Atlantic. And there's two men, one named Henry Kaiser, and the other one Howard Hughes, who was an aircraft designer, and they came up with this plan to build the biggest airplane ever imagined. It was supposed to be able to carry 750 fully equipped troops or two tanks. And the government contract to these people said it could not be built out of any aluminum or metal because there was a big shortage of it in the country at the time. So it was to be built out of wood. And most of it was birch wood, but the press nicknamed it the spruce goose or the floating lumberyard. Two phrases that Howard Hughes really despised. He did not like them talking about his precious project like this. About halfway through it, or several months into it, Henry got tired of it, and he backed out, leaving Howard Hughes to do the work himself. I mean, he obviously had a team of people, but he was the head of it. And in 1947, the thing still wasn't quite done. The war was over. This great big mammoth airplane. And he was called in front of the Senate at the time to give a hearing on how he was spending their government money. It was about a $23 million project back then, which I think they say is about $211 million in today's dollars. And he couldn't stand the feeling of pressure from the Senate at the time of feeling like a failure, spending their money and the government's money like a frivolous child. He just felt belittled. And the plane was almost done, but the war was over. They really didn't need it. But between hearings, he went back to California where it was being built, and he climbed in this thing, him and a crew of 23 people, and there was a total of 36 people. Some of it was press. And they did some taxi tests on this airplane, driving it around. By the way, it was an amphibious airplane, if I can say the word right, meaning it landed and took off on water. And he started taxiing it around the bay. And all day long, he taxied it. And he wasn't supposed to take it off. But he simply could not resist, and on the last taxi of the day, he ran it out as far as he could, and he got it 70 foot off the ground. He flew it for 26 seconds, and then he landed it. And he felt he'd finally proved to the government and the nosy press and all of America that this was not a fraud and that he did not squander their hard-earned money. He felt like he'd finally proved it to everybody. But here's the funny thing. This huge mammoth wooden airplane, 218.8 inches long, 218 foot 8 inches long, 320 feet wingspan, 79 foot high, it weighed 250,000 pounds empty, it had 8 28 cylinder 3,000 horsepower engines, and the props on it were 17 foot long. It never flew higher than 70 foot. That was it. That was its only flight. It was a big, wooden, useless airplane without much of a future. It was kind of kicked around for a while. Nobody really wanted to own it. Nobody wanted to store it. What do you do with something like that? And it finally ended up being donated to the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum in McMinnville, Oregon. They took it apart and they hauled it there. With a lot of effort, it was a 1,055-mile trip. It took a barge, a train, and a bunch of trucks, and it was a huge undertaking just to get it there. They almost chopped it up because they didn't know what to do with it. It was too big for its own good. It was useless. And I actually got to clamber around in the cockpit of it a few weeks ago when we were out there. I had heard of the spruce goose before, but I didn't know much about it. And it's sitting out there in a museum. And it is huge. It floats on the water, it's supposed to. And it's made of this laminated birch wood that men and women spend hours ironing together with glue and whatever else they used. Some for laminated something that was supposed to work. And it's wood. It is wood. It's amazing. They said the man sitting in the tail in that 1 mile flight felt it flex. He pretty freaked out it was going to come apart, but it didn't. It hung together. But what do you do? I mean, here you have this big wooden millions and millions of dollar project. Too big for its own good. Isn't that how I am sometimes? It is how I am sometimes. So big, I about can't get out of my own way. Saul let his power go to his head, and he became a useless human for God. In fact, he hindered more than he helped. What about me? What about you? Power is intoxicating to some people, some more than others. You can look anywhere you want to, and you can find somebody in leadership somewhere that has messed this up. It might have started out ever so small and ever so right, but somewhere along the line, they or me lost sight of where we came from and where we're headed. You see, people in church leadership mess this up sometime, and that scares me. That could be me. Could be me. You see, people do it in politics, if you pay any attention to that, all the time. They start out wanting to do good and help the people, and they end up messing it up. You see it sometimes in homes where moms or dads take just a little too much delight in wielding every ounce of authority they can. You can find it in businesses sometimes where a man had a good idea and he started a good thing. And it went to his head. The power went to his head. And those are not businesses you want to work for. I can tell you that. The history books are full of people who wrecked their lives by being too big for their own good. Hitler was a prime example of that. Stalin and a bunch of, I mean, men with so much potential and so much leadership knowledge, and they knew how to influence people. You can go back and listen to some of Hitler's speeches. I can't understand it. It's German, but that man could talk. He was a salesman. It ain't no wonder he had a crowd of people following him. But the power went to his head. He was much too big for his own good. Power is an intoxicating thing in the human race. Always has been. Always will be. And it's pretty easy to look around and point at all the people that are doing it wrong. But what about if it's me? What about if it's me abusing power? I'm discovering that God wants us to be broken, stuck-up sticks. I almost titled the message that, but broken, stuck-up sticks. We're not much good to God if we are proud in our own way of where we are and our knowledge of where we're anything. We're not much good to God. I say broken and stuck-up sticks because we do need to be strong where we are in our Christian life. There's things in the Christian life we have to say, here's the line, and I'll die on this line. There's times to say that. But God needs you to be broken in order to use you. He needs me to be broken in order to need me to use me, whatever that includes. I'm 100% human, and I know I'm not above this problem. I'm not. And sometimes when we say Christians need to be broken, I get the idea that people can get the idea that Christians should be pushovers and just they don't stand for anything, they're pushovers. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about being broken before God and saying, God, here am I, wherever you send me, whatever you're going to ask me to do, I want to do it. We live in a country that lets us live our faith. And that's the exception rather than the norm in history. Do we know what we stand for? Do I know what I stand for? Do I know where my line is, where I won't cross it? Do you? Can we humbly stand on that line and say, this is where it stops for us? I read an article that the Billy Graham Association put out here recently, 12 Ways to Humble Yourself. And I read over that, and I thought, if somebody gets all of these right, you got it going on. I don't know if any human ever has got all of these right, but it's something we can strive for. And I'll read them to you. This wasn't wrote by me. It was wrote by somebody else. Number one was 12 ways to humble yourself. Routinely confess your sins to God. Acknowledge your sin to others. Take wrong patiently. Actively submit to authority, the good and the bad. Receive correction and feedback from others graciously. Accept lowly places. Purposely associate with people of lower state. Choose to serve, be quick to forgive, cultivate a grateful heart, purpose to speak well of others, treat pride as a condition that always necessitates embracing the cross. If a human can get, and we can't, but it's something we can strive for, if we can get all 12 of those down pat in our lives, that would be a good place to be. It's something we can... something I can work towards. We're not going to be perfect humans in this life, but we can strive to be what God wants us to be in His kingdom. A useful person. And if you are that person, you can't expect God to put you to work. He will find something for you to do. Isaiah 57:15 says, "For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place, with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble, and to revive the heart of the contrite ones." That's where God wants us. He wants us to be broken, stuck up sticks for him. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I think that's where we should strive to be to the best of our abilities. Broken, stuck up sticks for God. That's all I have for the message this morning. Why don't we kneel for prayer?